Today is Friday, August 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump announced Thursday Israel and the United Arab Emirates would formally recognize each other.
This is a truly historic moment. Not since the Israel-Jordan peace treaty was signed more than 25 years ago has so much progress been made towards peace in the Middle East.
What impact will this have on the region, and how will this foreign policy achievement affect the 2020 presidential election race?
I don't think that it'll have much impact on the 2020 election.
We'll have those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump on Thursday announced that Israel and the United Arab Emirates agreed to normalize relations. What's being called the Abraham Accord is only the third Israel-Arab peace deal since Israeli independence in 1948. In a joint statement, Trump, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed Al Nahyan said they hope the historic breakthrough will advance peace in the Middle East. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekeswara starts us off.
Emirati Muslims can now pray in the historic Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem after the United Arab Emirates announced Thursday it has normalized relations with Israel. At the White House, President Donald Trump applauded the announcement.
Now that the ice has been broken, I expect more Arab and Muslim countries will follow the United Arab Emirates lead.
The UAE-Israel agreement is only the third Israel-Arab peace deal since Israel's declaration of independence in 1948. Egypt signed one in 1979 and Jordan in 1994. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a historic day, a sentiment supported by administration officials.
It wouldn't surprise me if the president's eventually nominated for a Nobel Prize.
As part of the deal, Israel has agreed to suspend further annexation of Palestinian land in the West Bank. Analysts say that taking annexation off the table benefits Israel strategically since it won't absorb a significant number of Palestinians against their will. The UAE-Israel deal is seen as further isolating another regional power, Iran. The U.S. is currently trying to push a U.N. Security Council resolution to extend an arms embargo on Tehran due to expire in October. China and Russia have signaled they will veto it. If the resolution fails, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has threatened to invoke the snapback option, restoring all U.N. sanctions on Iran.
We're not going to talk to you about that. We're going to work something out and then we'll talk after it's completed. But it'll be very satisfactory.
Trump said the UAE and Israel will join the U.S. to formally sign the agreement in Washington in the next few weeks. Patsy Wiedekeswara, VOA News at the White House.
Stepping back from the parties who are actually signing the deal, what's the impact of the Israel-UAE agreement on the region?
I do think this is very notable for Arab-Israeli relations. I do think that this sets a precedent for other Arab states to normalize relations with Israel, but I don't think that this is a major coup for Middle East peace.
That's Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst for the Rain Company Stratfor. Ori Neer is a spokesman for Americans for Peace Now, and he says that Tel Aviv's pledge to hold off on annexing parts of the West Bank may slow down the deterioration of Israeli-Palestinian relations.
But I think it's not very likely to enhance prospects for a renewed peace process or peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Neither is the normalization of Israeli-UAE relations. The real problem that Israel has is the ongoing occupation and the de facto annexation through settlement activity and other Israeli government measures.
He says that real prospects for peace won't likely manifest until Israel enacts policies that end measures that perpetuate the occupation.
Whenever there's any sort of deal, a normalization or a peace deal announced, every actor in that negotiation has their own interests. This UAE-Israel deal, it suits both countries. The UAE looks like a leader on the Palestinian issue, looks like a leader in the Arab world. Israel gets a pause while they figure out the best way forward for future settlement and annexation plans that were already hung up based on U.S. concerns, based on internal concerns within Israel. So this is a near-term win for both of these countries.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he was committed to extending sovereignty over the area, and that was still on the table and his plans haven't changed. That's something Hawthorne says could be problematic for Abu Dhabi.
The UAE is going to be caught in a difficult place trying to guarantee Palestinian statehood while also maintaining a normalized relationship with Israel. So this deal is notable, but it's bound to incur tension and friction in the medium and long term.
President Trump predicted more countries would formalize relations with Israel and that great things would develop regarding Israeli-Palestinian relations, but Nir tempered that assessment.
Frankly, I don't believe that Israel's gradual improving of its relations with Gulf states is likely to pressure the Palestinians to accept the terms of Trump's so-called peace plan. It's important to remember that detente of sorts in relations between Israel and the UAE and Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, Oman, Bahrain, has been ongoing for quite some time, mostly tacitly. What has happened, while definitely positive in and of itself, is basically formalizing what has been informal relations or an informal relationship for quite some time between Israel and the UAE.
So, what is the roadmap to peace in the Middle East? Are we near again?
Comprehensive peace in the Middle East, an end to the Israeli-Arab conflict, could only be achieved through an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
But Hawthorne asserts that for peace to be achieved in the Middle East, something must be done that goes beyond the Israeli-Palestinian issues.
I think it's really important for all sides of any conflict to be equally at the negotiation table. That hasn't been the case.
Thursday's announcement provided a foreign policy victory for the Trump administration days before the Democratic National Convention is set to begin. I chatted with Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert earlier about what impact the agreement may have on the upcoming presidential election.
I think it's a great victory and a timely victory for President Trump and his team. So I think it is his first real major foreign policy success, first major diplomatic success. I don't think that it'll have much impact on the 2020 elections. I think most voters right now are tuned out of international relations, international affairs, and with the Mideast peace process, and they're much more focused on coronavirus, on Trump's personality or presidential leadership style, and on, of course, the presumptive nominee in Biden's vice presidential pick, I think will be more determining than anything in the Middle East right now. So I don't think we'll see much of this helping or hurting President Trump, but he certainly will try to use it himself as a narrative or a framing message to boost his chances and boost his credibility for foreign policy, which, of course, Vice President Joe Biden, former Vice President Biden, has lots of foreign policy experience from being the vice president.
Speaking of former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic National Convention kicks off in earnest on Monday, August 17th, and people are concerned about the coronavirus, the state of the United States economy, and what can be done to turn things around after dealing with the pandemic for so many months. So when the convention begins on Monday, what do you think, you know, Vice President Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris need to do to move their vision for America forward?
You know, this is something that we just have no idea how it's going to turn out. I'm not quite sure that the convention will make much of a mark because of it being mostly virtual. I doubt there's going to be high viewership. There might be, but we just don't know what it's likely to be. I don't think it'll be as influential as we've seen the conventions in the past be. I think for the most part, if you look at the polls, most Americans are pretty set in for whom they're going to vote already. I think there is only a 12% point of those that might change their mind. And so, of course, there's some margin of errors with these polls, but a 12%, you know, might be able to change their mind. And with Biden leading in most of the polls between 8 and 11 percentage points already, I think that's giving us indicators that the people's minds are made. Whose minds aren't made might be the small centrist independent voter who's still just not sure. And I think more than the convention, what might help sway their decision, Vice President Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris for his running mate. So I think that might have more of a determining factor than convention in and of itself.
What do you think the major tone of the next few months of the 2020 election is going to be, both from the Republicans and from the Democrats?
That is a great question. I think from the Democrats, we can certainly see one of compassion and empathy. You could only see this in the speeches given by Senator Harris and Vice President Joe Biden in their announcing the ticket, and that it was very conciliatory, very unified in its approach and its tone, you know, and a way to kind of inspire hope in the future of America to reunify the country is with Biden and Harris's message there. I'm not sure what the Trump campaign will do now. President Trump has tend to rely on a kind of divide and conquer narrative, a messaging of, let's say, less compassion than what some would expect from presidential leadership. I think we can continue to see that. I think we'll probably see the president start to poke at Kamala Harris a little bit more. I think that might be one of the tactics of the Democrats, in fact, is to kind of bait president to attack her and take some of the heightened tension away from Joe Biden, for instance. So I think you can see that the president probably increases his attacking tone towards the Democrats and towards mail-in ballots as well. So he's going to do anything he can to make sure that his prospects are increased in his mind, at least.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia. And coming up later,
it will grow before it slows, and it may continue to be linked to schools, churches, and social gatherings as it has done to date.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
One of the brightest stars in the sky is Betelgeuse. In October 2019, astronomers noticed that the star was decreasing in brightness. NASA says that by mid-February 2020, Betelgeuse had lost more than 66% of its brilliance. This unusual dimming set off talk in the scientific community that the red supergiant was getting ready to explode into a spectacular supernova. Scientists at the Space Telescope Science Institute and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics recently observed Betelgeuse with the Hubble Space Telescope. They say the drop in the star's brilliance was probably due to it ejecting a vast amount of material into space, which then formed into a dust cloud that blocked light coming from its surface. The scientists suggest the dust cloud formed after the star released some super hot plasma. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Survivors and relatives of the victims of the massive explosion that struck Beirut last week called for an international and independent investigation Friday.
With the court's full competence to impose all sanctions, penalties, monetary damages, and remedies, and full jurisdiction to prosecute any Lebanese and non-Lebanese private and public person directly and or indirectly involved in this crime against humanity.
The massive blast left at least 180 people dead and an estimated 6,000 injured. At least 30 people are still missing. George Ede reports from Beirut and visited the blast site on Thursday. He shares his story with VOA through WhatsApp.
Well, for the first time, I must say that I've been there for a week now. Last time I was there, it was 10 days ago. So for the first time since the explosion occurred, the Lebanese media was allowed to examine the site of the blast closely under the supervision of the Lebanese army. I must say that not a lot remains of the Beirut port. It brought a lot of memories of what happened that day. I can still remember where we found a lot of bodies. On the afternoon of Thursday 13th, we went in again. So reporters and cameramen were led to the site where the search and rescue teams are working on Beirut port. It was clear that a big part of the rubble that once dominated the area of the silos has been removed aside, as more human remains were dug out of the area. So rescue teams have managed to pull out a car from the water of the port where a human body was found stuck inside. Amidst the dust and rubble, hope remains to find out what happened to those reported missing.
George, the port is so vital to so many in Beirut. And with some 300,000 people being left homeless and a huge concern about a shortage of food, what's being done to make sure that goods are coming into the city to help those that so desperately need it?
But luckily, the cranes at the port have started working again. By some miracle, they were saved. So we have still three cranes that are functioning, two to be put back on power next week. So this helps a bit. However, we do have a problem when it comes to food and everything, because 85% of everything that enters Lebanon enters through this port. So international entities and countries have vowed to support the Lebanese people through food, provisions, until the port is up and working again. It is important also to point out from the side of the investigation that Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs David Hale met with the President Michel Aoun at Baabda Palace Friday. On the second day of his three-day visit, Hale announced that the FBI would soon be arriving to Beirut to provide its expertise and assistance to the investigation into the circumstances that led to the devastating Beirut port explosion.
Immediately following the blast, protesters took to the streets calling for change. It did result in the government stepping down, but there's still a lot of questions that haven't been answered yet as to why, after being notified so long that these chemicals were theirs, the government let that happen. Are there still plans to continue that protest movement?
Well, a lot of protests are being organized, and a lot of people are demanding for justice, not only local justice, but international justice. We've been hearing a lot of calls today. A press conference on Friday happened by the victims and through activists and lawyers going on and saying that an international investigation and court should be held to find out what caused the explosion and to hold accountable all those who came in power since 2013 until today, because all of the governments and presidents who came from 2013 until 2020 have been made aware in some way or the other that these explosives have been placed there and are a danger to society and might cause a catastrophe.
George Eade reports from Beirut, Lebanon. There are more than 20 million COVID-19 cases around the world, and with more than 759,000 deaths, the global community will likely soon reach the 1 million death tally. In the United States, state officials say a glitch in California's COVID-19 reporting system undercounted the state's infections by as many as 300,000 cases. New Zealand is extending its nationwide lockdown after more COVID-19 infections were detected. And Phil Mercer brings us that story.
A dozen new COVID-19 cases have been detected in New Zealand. In a country where until this week there were no local infections for more than 100 days, this number is significant. A three-day nationwide lockdown due to expire Friday is being extended. The emergency centres on a cluster of cases in Auckland. The origin of the infections is still being investigated. 38 people are in government quarantine. New Zealand's biggest city will remain under level 3 coronavirus restrictions until later this month at least. Bars, restaurants and schools are shut, and most workers forced to stay at home. The rest of New Zealand, a country of 5 million people, is on a level 2 lockdown in a 4-tier alert system, which means public gatherings are limited to 100 people and strangers must physically distance. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says her cautious approach is warranted as the COVID-19 outbreak gets worse.
It will grow before it slows, and it may continue to be linked to schools, churches and social gatherings as it has done to date. In keeping with our precautionary approach and New Zealand's philosophy of going hard and going early, today Cabinet has agreed to maintain our current settings for an additional 12 days.
Last month, the World Health Organization highlighted New Zealand as an example for having successfully eliminated community transmission. In June, Prime Minister Ardern said the country had united in unprecedented ways to crush the virus. But the new cases are a reminder, even in places where the virus had seemingly vanished, that outbreaks can still happen. New Zealand's international borders remain closed to foreign nationals. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
European Union foreign ministers are meeting Friday regarding possible sanctions against Belarusian officials following the mass arrests of demonstrators opposing the country's recent election results. From Paris, Nicolas Pinot.
Ahead of the special video call of the EU's foreign ministers, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen tweeted that additional sanctions were needed against those who violated democratic values or abused human rights in Belarus. I am confident today's EU foreign ministers' discussion will demonstrate our strong support for the rights of the people in Belarus to fundamental freedoms and democracy, von der Leyen tweeted. The top diplomats from the bloc's 27 member states are reviewing former restrictions against Belarus party leadership that the EU removed in 2016, seeing progress in improving the rule of law. The sanctions had targeted arms companies, frozen assets, and implemented travel bans. The video talks were called after a controversial election win for President Alexander Lukashenko and days of violence against anti-government protesters. Protests against the government in Belarus were sparked by the re-election of Lukashenko for his sixth term in office with 80% of the vote. He has held the presidential position since the role was created in 1994. His opponents have claimed that the result was rigged. The EU criticized the vote as neither free nor fair. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News in Paris.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Charles Hikubwabo, a former municipal official in the Republic of Rwanda, is wanted for taking part in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. In his capacity as mayor of the Gijita commune in Kibwe Prefecture, Hikubwabo is accused of directing communal and national police to hunt down individuals who fled there to escape the violence. He faces charges that he personally participated in an attack on a church where Tutsi civilians had sought sanctuary, as well as attacks in the hills where other people had fled. For these and other crimes, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, now known as the International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals, indicted Hikubwabo on charges of genocide and war crimes and issued a warrant for his arrest. The United States is cooperating with other governments, the United Nations, and the residual mechanism to make it harder for Hikubwabo and the others implicated in the killings to continue to elude justice. To achieve that end, the U.S. is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest. If you or anyone you know has information on Charles Hikubwabo's activities and whereabouts, you can provide it with complete confidentiality. Please visit the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate website to contact the Regional Security Office. Email the U.S. War Crimes Rewards Program at wcrp@state.gov or contact us via WhatsApp on +1 202 975 5468. You can also visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/War Crimes Rewards Program or follow us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/War Crimes Reward for photos of the wanted fugitives. All credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.